Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, when I was a little kid growing up in West Miami, we lived on the edge of the Everglades on a big man-made sand berm on which little starter houses for young families and their baby boom kids were built. I mean, it was paradise for kids. We'd all boil out of our houses at the same time and play all day, but it was surrounded by a chain-link fence, and on the other side of the fence was wild country. Alligators would often crawl up and sun themselves on the sandbank like a Tarzan movie, right? And you had to watch out for moccasins. That's snakes, for those of you who don't know. And I had a little canoe and would sometimes paddle out into the glades and spend all day by myself just watching. It was fascinating and really helped to shape me as a person in many ways. Of course, today my parents would be arrested for child endangerment, but back then it was no big problem and I just had to be home in time for dinner. My guest today is Sonny Bass, who was for many years the supervisory wildlife biologist for the National Park Service in the Everglades National Park, until he retired recently. And that means he probably knows more about both the well-known and the hidden lives of wildlife in the park and their history than anyone alive. He's my guest today. Welcome, Sonny.
Well, thanks for having me on your program.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on. I'm thinking you might be one of those rare people who end up with their dream job. Are you?
Oh, yeah, Court, absolutely. I had the job that I always dreamed of having. Ever since I was 9 years old, I knew what I wanted to do and was fortunate enough to be able to do it.
What path did you follow to find your way into doing exactly what you wanted to do at the age of nine?
Well, listening to your opening remarks, it made me think of myself. And I spent most of my time outside at a very, very early age. So I don't know. I think it's just something that kind of gets in your system, in your blood, so to speak. And if you love doing it, you pursue a career where it allows you to do that. And that's what I did. And so, you know, everything from that through schooling and then finding a dream job was the answer to meet my greatest wish.
So I guess you grew up in South Florida, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I grew up in Homestead, right on the edge of the Everglades. In fact, it's the gateway to Everglades National Park. And at an early age, I went with my father into the park. And this was in 1953, when the old road was the only means of getting in there. I remember it distinctly because the water back then was flowing over the road, and that has stuck in my mind ever since.
Yeah, I'm a little bit younger than you, just a couple of years, so basically we're the same age, and I can remember going over with my folks on Tamiami Trail to Naples, from Miami across the state to Naples, and having to stop on the road, which was a two-lane road at the time, and to stop there because it'd be like a 14-foot alligator lying across the road, sunning himself on the warm spot up above the water, and honk the horn and kind of edge forward and, you know, dealing with this giant leviathan, you know, and trying to get it off the road. And it was just for, you know, a five-year-old kid. It was pretty much an adventure. And, you know, so anyway, how long did you end up then working in the glades professionally?
Professionally for 36 years. I was the a field biologist there. I started in 1976 and retired in March of 2012. It was just a dream job. I'm absolutely a dream job. I got to do the things I always wanted to do, and I got paid for it, which is, although my family always said, you know, we think you would end up doing that for free if you could just do it. And I think they're probably right. I probably would have.
Yeah, if they would have just fed you.
Yes, right? Yeah. My wife's a school teacher, a retired school teacher. And so if I could have, we could have gotten by on one, I probably would have done it for free just to do it. You get to be able to live the life you always wanted to live. And I was incredibly fortunate to be able to do that.
I often have on the show, artists and performers and people who do what they love as well. And sometimes I'll start off the show saying the advice you often get when you're young is follow your passion and do what you love. But if it's in the performing arts or the arts, that can be a really hard row to hoe. And, you know, and I sometimes will say kind of tongue in cheek, you know, if it's great if what you love is to be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant or an engineer or something, then that's doable. But if it's being, you know, an actor or whatever, then, that advice can be basically a recipe for depression and poverty, you know. But in your case, it's one of those jobs that is more interesting and is something you made a living at, as you say, and you followed your dream and were able to live it all the time. So Well, let's talk about some of the things that you ran into and ran during those years and were heavily involved in. I mean, I know one of the big wildlife projects, Sonny, in recent decades has been the reintroduction of panthers into Florida to try to save the species, which had gotten down to, you know, some arguable but small number of, you know, 100 or less individual panthers. And it's a complicated project. So why don't you kind of give us a thumbnail overview of that whole effort?
Yeah. You know, the Florida panther was listed as an endangered species and one of the first lists in 67, then finalized in 73 under the Endangered Species Act. And then the state of Florida also had it listed as an endangered animal. And, you know, the very first thing that needed to be done was just to determine if the animal still existed in Florida. And so early effort put forth by the state to determine that was just going out in the field and trying to document, find either pictures or sign of the animals that you can get solid confirmation of it. And so the early times was spent doing that. And then once some evidence was found of it, then there was the whole, well, what next? And then it was to, you know, get your hands on the animals so you can find out a little bit about their history. In other words, being able to follow them. And of course, that's done through radio telemetry. And again, the state was the lead on that with the federal government because we were the land managers in some of the biggest holdings, Everglades and Big Cypress. We participated in that. I remember in 1978 finding the first documented sign of the panther in Big Cypress National Preserve in the eastern side. And it was kind of a, you talk to some of the woodsmen there and they knew they were there. They had seen them. But, you know, scientists are, they're an odd lot. You know, they want proof. They want concrete evidence. And so walking up a trail one day, I found tracks of the animal. And the irony of irony, it was, they had hunting camps back and still do in the preserve. And as you might imagine, I'm walking along and I happened to look up at the camp and the camp name was Panther Camp. So obviously the, you know, the the people that lived there knew they were there. But, you know, you build upon that, and then you move forward. So that took the state into doing radio telemetry work starting in 81, and the Park Service starting it in 86. And then as we built the information that came from that, looking at getting an idea of basic demographic information like numbers, reproductive viability, survivorship, things like that, through all that effort, it became pretty clear that we were dealing with, as you mentioned earlier, a really small number of animals. And as that progressed and people got into it, the agency's concerns on this, it was through some genetics work that was done, it was determined that this population was pretty highly inbred, which really came as no surprise, I don't think, to anyone. So as a result of a suggestion was made that they bring in some outside genes, which would be the closest surviving subspecies, which was the one from West Texas, and bring in a small number of those, and these were all females, that we could turn loose and that would, you know, hopefully breed with the males there, and thereby kind of giving it a genetic shot in the arm. And so 8 females were brought in and released, and they were released in various sections throughout Everglades and the Big Cypress and those lands. And as you might imagine, hope was realized on that, and the animals bred right away and started producing young. And so with that and some follow-up work looking at the success of that, the numbers started to increase. It did exactly what we thought might happen. Animals were more healthy. All the parameters we looked at indicated that. And as those numbers increased, the animals started to spread out and reoccupy some of the areas that they historically did occupy. And so it's been quite the success, you know, success story.
Any idea how many panthers are alive today in Florida?
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen the recent numbers, but the last I'd heard, there were probably somewhere around 200 individuals, which has been quite a success over, you know, the low estimate at one time was thought that there were probably no more than 20 individuals left. And I think, you know, the thing about that was it was the cooperation by not only state and federal, but private lands people too, supporting this. And, you know, during this period of time, the panther became the state animal, you know, voted on by the children of the state of Florida. So it's really, you know, a success story for this animal, because there are only 200 left or thereabouts, and there's only so much wild land for them. The animal could always be in danger of going extinct again. And so proper monitoring and eyes on the animal at least can keep it for foreseeable future.
You know, it's always possible there are more than they think there are, too. I mean, I told you, Sonny, before the show when we were first talking about a time when I was 15 years old and I was hunting at night, which you weren't allowed to do. I guess the statute of limitations has probably expired by now because it was 1965, I guess. And,
right.
And I was on a ranch that was owned by some friends of my parents, so I was allowed to be there, and I was hunting over Christmas vacation with some friends. But I saw something across a field that I was hunting deer, and I didn't think it was a deer, but I didn't want to shoot and have it be a cow either. So I walked closer and closer to it, and I got about 15 to 20 feet away, and it suddenly stood up in the cane brake, the bamboo thicket that it was in. And I saw that it was a panther. And at the same time it stood up, it screamed really loud. I mean, it was a horrifying sound. I can hear it today, even though it's, you know, more than 50 years later. And so I turned and ran. I mean, I ran like the wind. I must have broken, you know, the half mile record by several seconds. I threw my gun down and ran, right? And this, I could kind of hear it behind me in my imagination as I ran. But anyway, there was, you know, one very healthy panther that I walked up on in 1965. And who knows if that was counted at the time, you know. But anyway, they were there, and it's great that they're still there thanks to the efforts of people like you. So,
yeah, and I think sightings like yours and others, that's, as I mentioned early on, that's what they did. They tried to build these observation files to try to see if there was a kind of a center where people, and, you know, they would go out and check these out. Many times they found out that they were misidentified, but in some cases they found, you know, sign of the animal. So, you know, it's one of those things that an animal as elusive as a panther, people, they're rarely seen. And those that are seen, some people report, some people don't. But, you know, I think with people being aware that the animal is out there, I think gives a lot of people kind of satisfaction, I think, to know that there's still a little bit of wild Florida left.
Yeah, especially, you know, kind of a beautiful wild Florida like that, you know, not just a snake or a turtle or something, but something so majestic. You know, but on the other hand, then, sunny Florida seems to be ground zero for invasive species. From, you know, I don't know, water hyacinths to Melaleuca trees to giant cane toads and walking catfish and all kinds of exotic things that are brought in and into pet stores and released during hurricanes or released during people who get tired of them or they outgrow them or whatever, and they let them out in a canal or out in the Everglades. And in recent years, the really bad one, the Burmese python, has been basically a catastrophic threat to the Everglades ecosystem. So, you know, give us a kind of a quick overview of how the Glades is handling these threats. And I realize it's a whole array of things, but, you know, the Burmese python, for example, just kind of quickly.
Yeah, well, you know, you just gave a good synopsis about how this happens. You know, South Florida is kind of the import capital of the world for exotic pets trade. And you just described how many of them get turned loose into the environment. And the python, according to the work that was done, that's probably the way it got started, that, you know, you go in and you buy this nice little small snake and you keep it in your terrarium, your cage, and then the snake grows up and your mother says, we can't have that in the house. And so instead of dispatching the snake, which you can kind of understand, you say, well, I'll just take and turn it loose. And that's how many of these animals have gotten, and plants have gotten started in the wild. And for places like Everglades, Burmese python have become a huge problem. And a problem trying to control it is, we had one of the guys that I work with, that was one of his primary jobs was to figure out some of the best ways to find them and try to control them by eradicating them. Very difficult. You know, other things are exotic fishes that have gotten into the park. Many of the areas you can go to now that are visitor areas in the park, when you look down in the water, you're apt to see more exotics fish than you would native fish. And so there, it's a real issue.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the really far south Florida is tropical. I mean, it's just like the Caribbean and so on. So anything that can live in Venezuela or Colombia can also live in South Florida. And that's and the stuff comes in from all over the world in packing crates and what have you, in addition to people letting them go. So it's kind of crazy. But, you know, who knows?
it's the perfect habitat.
The Glades have been so changed. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a huge terrarium in a way.
Yeah.
So, you know, turning to kind of some of the good things, though, one of the almost mythical organisms in the Glades is what's called the ghost orchid, which is a very rare and beautiful orchid. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, out there, like I described earlier, I would see orchids sometimes up in the trees, along with bromeliads and Spanish moss, of course, and things. But I never saw a ghost orchid that I know of, and I think they're very rare and only grow in very limited places. Have you seen them?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I've been fortunate to see it and see it in flower. But as you say, it's very localized.
Wow.
And so very hard to find.
Mm-hmm. I think there are people who go out and illegally collect them and sell them for thousands of dollars or whatever. But
yeah, the plant trade like that, especially for natives, was a real issue many years ago. I think that's subsided a good bit now, but you know, as they say, the damage has already been done. So it really reduced the population of many of them. You know, there were some rare orchids found in Everglades and Big Cypress.
Yeah, so you got that too. Not only, you know, the habitat destruction and everything else, but then people just collecting them. So that's the other part of why things get spoiled and disappear and go extinct eventually. But you know, one thing I think that was thought maybe at one time, or maybe two things that were thought to be extinct at one point, were crocodiles and, you know, in Florida, and sawfish. And so those, I think, have both come back to some extent. Have you seen crocodiles and sawfish there in your work?
Oh, yeah. Worked with guys on crocodile. Yeah, the crocodile population has really increased, and to the point where it's been, you know, downlisted to threaten category and is now spread throughout the park in places that it didn't, or at least hasn't been found in a generation. So they've done really well. The sawfish is a less, I think, less known species. I've seen them in the park, and I think it gets kind of back to like the panther. What you try to do is get as much information. So, you know, there's kind of the citizen science that's out there. You know, you post up things. If you see this fish, please report where you saw it. So exact numbers on that, I don't think they have a feel for yet.
I forget. Is that a type of shark or a type of ray? I mean, it looks like
it's kind of a shark.
It's
in that group.
But it's got a long, elongated snout that...
Yep.
You know, that looks like the front end of a chainsaw. You know,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And
they can grow really long. I mean, you know, 15 feet or something.
Yeah. And if you've lived in Florida, and you probably have seen this. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was a child growing up, I could go into some of the, you know, some of the bait stores and things like that. And they would catch them and cut off that, whatever you want to call it, snout, the saw itself, and they'd hang them on the wall, you know, and you would see those things from time to time. Of course, you know, now they're protected, so you can't do that, but it just kind of gives you some sense of, you know, the numbers were probably reduced as a result of, you know, doing things like that, just not knowing. I always like to call it, just being unaware of things like that. You know, if you're raised in an area like that, that's what people do, then that's what people do. And usually species like that don't get in the situation until no one starts seeing them and they start getting concerned about it. That's usually what brings that to the forefront.
It's like that old line, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. I think they were, you know, back in the early 20th century, they were fairly prevalent, but they also went into shallow water. And so You know, fishermen would see them. They would get entangled in nets. Things like that, and they would tear up their nets, and they would go, "Well, I don't need this," so they'd kill them. They saw them enough that didn't occur to them they were rare.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Sonny Bass, who is the retired supervisory wildlife biologist for many years for the National Park Service in the Everglades National Park, about his, you know, many, many years, decades in that job out in the Everglades, and the kind of the changes he's seen and the things he's been involved in and trying to maintain the park in some kind of a healthy state. So, Sonny, you must have had a lot of memorable experiences. Why don't you pick one, if you can, out of your memory bank and give us a short story?
Yeah. Well, I have to think about that one for a moment. There's been a few. Probably...
Yeah, just, you know, off the top of your head.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the very first thing was the first panther that we caught in the park in Everglades is probably the thing I remember, one of the things I remember about the most, and most monumental for me, is actually seeing it and laying my hands on it to do work. That was a special moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, almost like a UFO. It's just a very rare and special object, you know, and this thing here, this living thing that you're seeing, that you know how rare it is, golly.
You know, the thing about a moment like that, at least for me, was what it led to. And that was the specialness. Learning about it, you know, providing that information to management, making good decisions, helping them make good decisions about it, and then really, you know, recovering that species was, you know, kind of the culmination of all of that, which is, to me, just something I'm quite proud of.
Well, I don't blame you. Yeah, it was kind of the reward for your work, and you saw it there in front of you. So, you know, I mentioned a minute ago UFOs, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but along that line, what's the strangest thing you ever saw in the Everglades?
I think one of the strangest thing I ever saw was we were doing some work out in the marsh in Shark Slough, and we came across a python that had attempted to eat an alligator. And it didn't work out well for either one. They both died. But here is this big snake that's trying to eat this very large alligator. And like I said, both of them died as a result of it. I mean, the snake killed the alligator, but the alligator killed the snake by, I guess it was one of those eyes too big for what it thought it could do.
Yeah, I might have choked to death. Actually, I think I saw that picture on the internet years ago. So you were the one who probably took the picture.
Yeah, it was an odd, crazy thing.
We have another. There was another thing that was kind of odd too that I can ask you about. So back in the mid-2000s, there was a lot of excitement about the apparent rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which had been thought to be extinct and was just recently officially declared extinct, actually. And the Florida swamps used to be a major part of their original range. Did you or anyone you know ever see one or said they had?
I've never seen one. I've heard people describe things that they thought could have been, but no one that I know of ever saw one that would just come out and say, "Hey, I saw an ivory-bill woodpecker." Ivory-bill's kind of as you probably well know, is the real ghost bird, is the grail, is the kind of the mythical bird that everybody that's interested in things like that have some strong feelings about.
Yeah, even beyond the panther, it's one of those, as you say, mythical things that, you know, at least the panther is well known to exist, and the ivory bill is now declared extinct, but some people still think there might be two or four or six of them somewhere. And you know, and they were big and beautiful, and you know, kind of an icon of the wildness of what remained of wilderness in the United States. So, well, you know, even back when I was a young kid in the 1950s, the Everglades were already drying up due to drainage programs that have been going on for decades. And you know, we just have a minute or so left, Sonny. But is the Everglades still the river of grass at all? It was as it was once called. I mean, is it still a slow-moving, shallow, sheet of water moving south from Lake Okeechobee down toward Florida Bay, or is it just pools of water here and there? Or what's it like as far as the water in the Everglades?
Well, yeah, it's, of course, the system's been altered quite a bit as a result of the canal systems that were put in. And so it doesn't have the flow from the lake south as it would have historically. But with the, you know, with the Everglades Restoration Initiative that took place and started out in the early 2000 and then continuing on, there's been a great deal of effort made to reconnect it and have it flow more naturally. And they've had some success doing that. So I think it's hopeful. Is it like it was historically? No. And I don't think there's any realization that that would ever happen again because of the surrounding areas and what all that would require. But it is hopeful. So as far as the persistence of the Everglades, I think that's a very sure thing, so to speak. But, it is something that's a managed system, and so it takes the proper management to make the system function. You know, there are a lot of interested parties that work on that, so I always like to be optimistic about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's pretty clear that it's all been, the story of the Everglades has been a story of a long, slow decline, but it does sound like you're optimistic that it will survive as an intact ecosystem, you know, even a big intact ecosystem, in part because it's a national park, right? And so is that valid? I mean, you think it'll just still survive into the future and not be just burned up and dried up into nothing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are challenges, and there's always challenges as, you know, trying to manage an area like that. But I think because of the commitment that both the federal government and the state governments have toward these kinds of things, it benefits, you know, it benefits everyone. It benefits all the citizens of the U.S., and it certainly benefits the people of South Florida. So, I think, you know, you don't let your guard down. You do what's necessary to monitor the things that could give you an indication of the health of the system. And I think that's one of the benefits of the involvement of both the Park Service and outside agencies. And you know, there are a lot of conservation groups that have a lot of input into this system. So it has a lot of caretakers, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah. Well, Sandy Bass, we're going to have to leave it there. And I'm going to say something I don't think I remember ever saying on the show before, but thank you for your service in helping to keep the Everglades ever alive, right? Because it is a big national treasure, and it would well be gone without the efforts of people like you over decades. And so thank you for being on the show with us and talking about this national treasure, the Everglades.
Well, it was my pleasure, and it was an honor working for the National Park Service.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.